From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, back in the live radio booth for the second time in 2 weeks, which feels great. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with the author Patrick Hicks, whose new novel is In the Shadow of Dora, a novel of the Holocaust and the Apollo program, published by Stephen F. Austin University Press. Patrick Hicks is the author of The Collector of Names, Adoptable, and This London. He also wrote the critically and popularly acclaimed novel The Commandant of Lubecek. He has been published widely in some of the most vital literary journals in North America, and his poetry has appeared on NPR, the PBS NewsHour, and American Life in Poetry. He has been a finalist for an Emmy, and he has received grants and fellowships from the Bush Artist Foundation, the Loft Literary Center, and the National Endowment for the Humanities, among others. A dual citizen of Ireland and America, he is the writer-in-residence at Augustana University, as well as a faculty member at the MFA program at Sierra Nevada University. When not writing and teaching, he is the host of his own radio show, Poetry from Studio 47. He lives in the Midwest with his wife and son. In the Shadow of Dora spans two very different decades, from the Nazi concentration camp of Dora Mittelbau to the coast of Central Florida in the late 60s. The book tells the story of the real-life intersections between the horror of the Third Reich's V-2 rocket program and the wonderment of the Apollo missions. Eli Hessel, a brilliant young Jewish mathematician, finds himself deep beneath a mountain where he is forced to build Nazi rockets. When he's finally freed from this secret underground concentration camp, he immigrates to New York, studies astrophysics, and is recruited by NASA to help build the largest rocket ever to rise above a launch pad, the Saturn V. To his shock, though, he will be under the command of former Nazi scientists, Werner von Braun and Arthur Rudolph, both of whom were at Dora. As America turns to the moon and cheers for rockets that lance the sky, Eli is swallowed up by the past and must cope with memories he thought were safely buried. As you will hear, my interview with Patrick Hicks begins with my first question. I hope you enjoy our conversation. So I thought that we could start out by just talking about Dora. In the title of your book, Dora refers to the Dora Mittelbau concentration camp and Nazi rocket program. So I wanted to know how you came to know about Dora, and how did you decide to write about it?
From a very young age, I was always fascinated with the space program. I mean, I grew up in the 70s, and my father was really very interested in Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo. And when I was 10 years old, we went to the Kennedy Space Center, and I saw this massive Saturn V rocket. So from the very beginning, there was always this fascination with space flight. And then as I started to do research on the Holocaust, that's when I discovered about Dora Mittelbau. And it's a camp that very few people, I think, in America know much about. And there are some good reasons for that. It was behind the Iron Curtain. It was a secret concentration camp. And the more research that I did, these two sort of interests of mine converged very neatly, I think, to create this particular book. And my first novel was The Commandant of Lubecek, which is about the Holocaust, and that was a really brutal and very difficult novel for me to write, as it should be for this particular subject matter. So when it came time to write my second novel, I thought, well, let's focus on something a bit more uplifting and joyful. So I wanted to focus just on Apollo, but the Holocaust sort of sneaked in, and that's the genesis of this particular novel.
Yeah, okay, great. So your novel concerns Eli Hessel, a young Jewish man from Germany who emigrated to Poland with his family when he was a boy in hopes of evading Hitler's reign. And instead, through a course of a whole series of events that you elaborate in the book, he ends up at Dora. I was wondering if he's based on any historical figure, and if not, or if so, how did you find and develop his character?
He's not based on any historical figure, any one historical figure that I'm aware of. he's certainly an amalgamation of many different stories and many different sort of experiences and horrors that arose out of the Holocaust. It was certainly, after the war, where there were so many people that had survived the Holocaust, in particular Jewish people, and very well without a home. I mean, in many cases, their villages had been entirely annihilated and completely murdered, and there was no one to go home to. They'd lost their entire family. So in many cases, these sole survivors would seek out very distant relatives in maybe America or in maybe Palestine or maybe deep in Russia. So there were a number of Jewish survivors that did immigrate to the United States, and there were Jewish organizations, not surprisingly, in 1945 and 1946, which were welcoming them and helping to establish new lives for them in cities like New York in particular. So when I started to think about that, I thought, well, it seems very reasonable that Eli, who did lose his entire family in the Holocaust, would find his way to New York. And because he was working on these rockets, in Dora Mitzvah, the secret underground concentration camp, it seemed like a natural step that he would then potentially, his knowledge would lead him to work for NASA. So part one takes place in Dora Mitzvah, as you know, and part two takes place on the eve of Apollo 11 taking off. And what links these two parts is the arcing of a rocket, the V2 and the Saturn V, which in my estimation are the two most important rockets of the 20th century.
Now, you said you were raised in the 70s, so you missed the moonwalk, right? You were not born yet.
That's correct.
Like, I think everybody has their memory of certain moments in time, and I just have this memory of sitting on the carpet in our apartment in Newark, Ohio, watching a little black and white TV, and my whole family. I mean, everybody was around their TVs that day. It was amazing. And everybody remembers that moment. So I'm sorry you missed that.
No, I'm really envious, and how interesting that you were watching it in Ohio. And I don't know what's in the water in Ohio, but yeah. The Wright brothers came from Ohio, John Glenn came from Ohio, and Neil Armstrong came from Ohio. Right. So it's like that state is like foundational to the American space program.
Right. I love that point. Toward the end of the book, you have one of the co-workers in the Apollo 11 program say that to Eli about the something's in the water in Ohio. I had to laugh. All right. Well, so we've laid some groundwork. I wonder if this would be a good time for you to read from the book so that listeners have some idea of the narrative.
I'd be very happy to. And I'm just going to read the first three pages, and I'm not going to offer any sort of introduction. I guess that's part of my aesthetic as a writer, is I think the work should speak for itself. So this is chapter one, called Into the Tunnel. He was tired and cold when he arrived from Auschwitz. The moon hung above him, battered and beaten, as he trudged down a long concrete road with thousands of other men. The train that had carried him across Germany huffed in the night. A whistle pierced the frosty air. It was a single note, strangled into silence. The huffing engine took on water as he licked his dry lips. He tried to swallow. Searchlights paced the dark as dogs strained against their leashes, their front paws reeling the air. Guards stood along the road and yelled at the prisoners to move faster, faster. Behind him, bodies were tossed from the rail cars. They hit the pebbly ground in sickening hard thuds. Stones skittered away. Eli glanced at the moon. It looked like it had been pistol-whipped. It hung in the sky, wounded. "Move it, you pieces of filth!" Another voice chimed in, march in unison, your left, your left, your left. He had no idea where he was or where he was going. The shadowy bulk of a hill was on his right, and, in the bright moonlight, he could see a haze of pine trees lining its ridge. To his left were strange metal cylinders with nozzles on them. They were stacked on flatbed rail cars. The men kept moving, trudging, schlepping. Their wooden clogs clacked against the concrete road. Dogs continued to snap and bark. There was the smell of wet fur, and there was something else too, a smell he couldn't quite place. It was a mixture of coal and creosote. There was also, he breathed deeply, the smell of decaying bodies. Yes, he noticed it crawling into his throat now, the stink of rotting meat and grapefruit. That's what a corpse smelled like. Over the past few months, he had grown familiar with that smell, that reek. But where was he? The journey from Auschwitz had been hard. They'd been stuffed into wooden cattle cars, and as they rocked and clattered over hundreds of miles of tracks, men had to relieve themselves where they stood. They were crammed in cheek by jowl, and the weakest often slipped to the floor. There, in pools of urine and excrement, they rarely stood up again. Eli stumbled. He was woozy, his lips were chapped, and his tongue was a leather strap. It hurt to swallow. Worst of all, on his lower back, at the place where the spine meets the pelvic girdle, he had a large bruise. A hobnail boot had kicked him into the cattle car a few days ago when they left Auschwitz, and although he couldn't see it, he knew it must look like a horseshoe with studded dots. Whenever he twisted at the waist, a sharp firework of pain sizzled up his spine. He worried one of his vertebrae had been shattered, but there was nothing he could do about it. He had to walk faster. Faster. He wobbled and whirled himself forward. He squinted in concentration and tried to stay at the front of the line because, behind him, prisoners were being beaten with metal rods. The concrete road beneath his clogs was splashed with oil. Or maybe it was blood. It was hard to tell at night. "You rags, you pieces of filth! Your left, your left, your left! March in unison!" He ignored the nipping pain in his stomach and watched his feet move beneath him. The blue and white stripes of his trouser legs swung in and out of view. He wondered where they were being taken. A gas chamber, maybe? He'd seen such things happen at Auschwitz many times before. He'd seen whole families walk down a gravel path, and he'd seen the black tar of their burning bodies rumble up from the crematoria. Flames shot out from the chimney, and the whole sky above Auschwitz was stained a dull orange during the night. The heat from thousands and thousands of bodies made the moon shimmer as if it were underwater. He focused on his swinging legs and didn't think about his mother or father, his younger brother, his grandparents. They were gone. They'd been turned into ash long ago, and yet, somehow, he was still alive. "Faster, you sons of b-" guard yelled. He used a cigarette lighter to look at his wristwatch. "We don't have all night." A dog attacked a prisoner behind Eli. He didn't stop to help the man, not even when he heard the powerful jaws sink into the man's buttocks. The prisoner cried out in pain, but the growling dog refused to let go. He was dragged behind as the man continued to march forward, forward, ever forward. The dog's nails scratched against the road. An SS officer, tall, lean, a pinched face, pushed Eli out of the way and began hitting the man with a metal rod. It sounded like a rug being smacked clean of dirt. As they marched on, the cries from the man were like little waves washing out to sea. Soon, all Eli could hear was the sound of wooden clogs clomping against the road. Maybe he could run away. Barbed wire was on either side of him, and there was a guard tower illuminated beneath a searchlight up ahead. No doubt the fence was electrified, and no doubt plenty of machine guns bristled all around. To run would mean what exactly? All of Germany was a concentration camp. "Move it, you useless eaters, you pieces of filth." The guard was from Berlin. Eli could tell from his accent. How could he be so angry and so full of venom? What filled the Nazis with so much hate? While he was thinking this, something surprising and alarming appeared up ahead. The rail tracks gently curved into a mountain. There was a tunnel. Two massive sodium lights sparkled overhead like twin stars, and they cast long, eerie shadows on the ground. A cloud of moths jittered in the lights, and for several long moments he wondered what they must taste like. Dusty, he thought. He imagined a bit of wing stuck between his molars. When it became obvious they were going into the tunnel, Eli looked around in wild terror for a chimney or a vent. Were the gas chambers inside this underground place? Where were they being taken, and why? His muscles tense, and he almost stopped walking. He had to will his legs to keep on moving, even though he was afraid of what awaited ahead. "Calm down," he told himself. "Calm yourself. It didn't make sense to ship everyone halfway across Germany, only to kill them all. The Nazis could have done that easily enough in Auschwitz." "All is well," he whispered to himself. "All is well."
Thank you for reading that. And "all is well" is a little refrain that carries him through a lot of difficulty, even after the war. So that was, it's funny, it's very, very moving. It's very hard the material, but I like Eli right from the start, and I really could relate to the idea of just sort of like flying under the radar to just survive, like just fly under the radar and see if you can make it. And that seems to kind of work for him for a long time. Let's see. I wanted to ask you, there's something that I found really interesting about the narrative a little while after that, like maybe 20, 30 pages in. We are with Eli and we are sort of in his story. And then at the end of one of the chapters, the narrator says, "Before we shift our attention to the tunnels and all that happened there, a few final words need to be said about the camp's name, Dora." And then there's this kind of slight shift in narrative perspective from strict story to storyteller or maybe historian. And I found that really interesting. And that's not the only time where the narrative changes its tone a tiny bit. But I thought this was an interesting point we could talk about. Do you remember doing that?
I very much remember that, and that was not accidental on my part, because, you know, Dora Mittelbau was a secret underground Nazi concentration camp, and no one could know the camp. No one person could know the camp. I mean, even the commandant could not know the entirety of the camp. So I realized that Eli is, of course, the protagonist, and I really came to really admire and appreciate Eli, and it was really a moment of sorrow when I finished the book, because I grew really attached and very fond to him, so I was sorry to say goodbye to him. But I also realized that the camp experience is seen really only through his eyes. But I knew the reader needed to pan back to see the totality of the camp in a little greater respect. So there are sort of these chapters or these moments in chapters where we do pan back, and I offer an historical perspective so that the reader can at least understand the larger world that's swirling around Eli, even though he himself cannot.
Definitely, yeah. And at one point, at several points, you kind of sprinkle in some history and some science, and it shifts the narrative style somewhat, but offers really helpful information. And I'll ask you a little bit more about that later. Here's something, and I think I've always known that these people existed, but I wonder if you can talk about who the Kapos were, K-A-P-O, and how were they chosen to do the work that the Nazis assigned them?
I like very much how you worded that, Sheila. How were they chosen to do the Nazi work? Because they did the dirty work of the Nazis. Towards 1944, in virtually all of the concentration camps, and this includes Auschwitz as well, it was the prisoners that were running the camps. In so far as, I'm not talking administratively, I'm talking about the dirty work of unloading the trains and getting people into the gas chambers. And in Auschwitz, the SS themselves, they largely stood around, but the SS were the ones that put the gas in the chambers. But everything else was run by Kapos or maybe the Sonderkommando, and we could sort of talk about who they were and how they sort of fit into the death camps like Auschwitz. But Kapos were they were usually, but not always, criminals, and they usually had a very sort of violent streak, and there was a capo for every barrack, and they were in charge of the barrack. So it was their job to get the prisoners up, to get them to roll call, to keep them in line, to beat them if they weren't working quickly enough. And the capos were, not surprisingly, uniformly hated by the rest of the prisoners. So in exchange for doing the dirty work of the Nazis, they sometimes got their own bed. They certainly got better rations. They got better food. They themselves were not beaten. So the capos became this sort of secondary force of evil that all of the prisoners had to worry about. And of course, the primary force of evil in the concentration camps were the SS themselves.
Mm-hmm. Although it's great, there's this moment later in this, and I'm careful not to give too much away because I don't like spoilers, but there is a moment later where you have a scene where one of the SS, who we've become familiar with, he's a character who we get to know a bit, he gets actually yelled at by somebody who's above him, one of the, so I think it's more of one of the scientists or one of the people that's administratively organizing the rockets. And that was really, that was such an interesting moment because we are already at that point so used to seeing the cruelty, and it's almost like the SS are, you know, without question, nobody ever comes down on them. So I liked that you showed us that, that this hierarchy of power, it's just so cruel all the way up to the top. And this man doesn't get respect from those above him for the things that he does to those below him. You know, I mean, it's just, it's like this uniform tragedy. I didn't feel bad for the guy in that moment, but I did think it was interesting.
Yeah, and that was baked into the Nazi system across the Third Reich and also the countries that they conquered, this element of, you know, I guess I'll call it social Darwinism, where, and even at the highest of echelons, Hitler would often have two men, because it was a patriarchal organization, but Nazism was a patriarchal system, Hitler would have two men that were essentially doing the same job, and he would sort of sit back and see which one would outdo and outflank the other one. So, I mean, this sense of trying to skirt around and gain power ruthlessly was just baked into the Nazi ecosystem.
Let's talk a little bit about the research I'm sure you had to do in writing this book, although it's interesting that your last book was about the Holocaust, and so I'm sure that you already had quite a lot of information from that, too. But what did you use for sources? And I'm always curious to know when a book is, research-oriented, did you follow any leads that led to exciting or surprising information that maybe changed the book?
Yeah, the answer is yes, and I really enjoy doing research. I'm not an historian, but I am a writer that is really interested in history, and I feel a responsibility to get the history correct. So although I write historical fiction, I really put quite a bit of emphasis on the historical part. I want it to be accurate. So I did do an awful lot of research. I read a number of books on Wernher von Braun and the rocket program. I read a very, very large book about the history of Dora Mittelbau that was actually written by a prisoner who then became a history professor in France. So I read a number of books, watched a number of documentaries, and then I also went to Germany on two different occasions. So I went to Dora Mittelbau itself twice, and I got into the tunnels, and we can certainly talk about that, but I also got quite a bit of funding to go to the Kennedy Space Center and the Marshall Space Flight Center, where the Saturn V was tested, and also the Johnson Space Flight Center. So I mean, I'm just so grateful for the funding grant bodies that allowed me to do all of these research trips. I mean, in total, I got about $10,000 to do all of this research, and it was absolutely vital to do this. But to your second question about, you know, were there surprises? When it came time to write part two, and I knew it was going to be set in my country, in the United States in 1969, I was a bit naive at first because I thought, well, it's 1969, it's my country, I'm sure this will not be as hard historically to capture as, say, 1944. And I could not be more wrong, because I realized that although I know the history of my country well, I had to view the history of my country through the lens of a Holocaust survivor like Eli, and suddenly everything looked different to me. You know, he would look at the Vietnam War differently. He would definitely look at the civil rights marches in the South very differently. So I had to recalibrate, and I also found that because he had survived the Holocaust, I realized that he would have trauma that he would have to carry with him, and I needed to do quite a bit of research on what it would be like to carry the heavy, almost uncarryable load of surviving the Holocaust.
Yeah, that to me was really prominent. First of all, because, you know, through the whole first part of the book, we are rooting for him. We want him to survive. And really, that is the goal, survival. And as I said before, it's like flying below the radar so that you can get out and survive. But what does survival look like when you have been through something like this, right? And just how, what will life be like after? And I think it's interesting to read a book that treats PTSD before it's named, right? And so that was interesting to me.
I'm really pleased to hear that, because I worked really hard to help the reader sort of understand how he's coping and not at all coping at the same time with the Holocaust.
Right. We were talking about the PTSD before it had a name. And so this is from part two, but, you know, I thought it was so well done that you highlight how, and of course, when he was in the camp, he was only known by a number.
Yeah.
And that number is in place of his name. But then after the war, and he steps into his next life, and he works for the space program, he again has a number. And it's kind of like this triggering thing for him where he gets asked for his number every morning. And I thought that was really smart. There are other triggers that bring on what I would now call PTSD. But I thought that was very interesting. I just wonder if you, did you have to study, you said you studied that.
I did. And I've interviewed a number of survivors of the Holocaust. And there was one gentleman in particular who I interviewed several years ago. He actually grew up on the same street that Anne Frank grew up on. And I said, did you know Anne Frank? And he said, well, yes, of course. I was like, so did you play with her? And he's like, no, she was a girl. And I thought, well, yeah, that makes sense to me. But, you know, beyond that sort of moment of historical happenstance, what he told me about the daily burdens of the Holocaust, it really deeply influenced my first novel, The Commandant of Lubitsch, and that flowed over to this book as well. So in part two, and I'm not giving anything away, but I wanted the reader to, you know, I sometimes have like whole paragraphs where Eli is just sort of describing food. I mean, there's a whole paragraph on him just looking at his TV dinner, and I wanted the reader to maybe even get a little bored in that one paragraph, because I wanted the reader to realize how he is not taking that for granted. This fast, convenient food, and he is not taking it for granted.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting, those musings on food. You know, a lot of what gets him through his time in the camps are these fantasies that he kind of like zones out into. And some of them are dreams or sort of recollections of a happier time when he and his family were all together and, you know, his mother's meals and sitting. There's a lot of sitting by warm stoves, you know, and just heat yeah. and warmth and comfort. And then as the plot moves along, some of these dreams are of a possible future, which I thought was really interesting. You know, all of a sudden he's starting to fantasize about what might come. But then, after the war, there's this other thing that to me felt like those fantasies flipped on their side, and that was denial. It was like the way that he went into these denial moments, this sort of like, don't think about that, don't think about, you know, like, don't let yourself go into a silent musing, because you will go to a dark place and that's not safe, right? So that was very interesting, I thought.
I was kind of wondering what it must be like for someone like Eli to survive something like Dor Mittelbau. And then he's proudly involved with the space program. He's proudly a part of the Apollo program. And yet, the very people who are in charge of him were his tormentors at Dor Mittelbau. These were the very same Nazi, real-life Nazi scientists. I mean, I do not think it's a stretch to say that we would not have gotten to the moon without the Nazi technology. We needed Wernher von Braun and Arthur Rudolph and Kurt Diebus, and there's this whole cavalcade of real scientists that got us to the moon because of the Saturn V. And without that rocket, the payload that we needed to get to the moon never would have gotten to Earth orbit.
Right. Well, and it's interesting, you have this incredible epigraph? I always get that word wrong. Epitaph?
Oh, yeah.
Epigraph. At the beginning, the rocket will free man from his remaining chains, the chains of gravity, which still tie him to this planet. It will open to him the gates of heaven. Wernher von Braun. And it's like, that was such a great quote to find for the beginning of this book, because he doesn't really care about the chains that were, you know, metaphorically or really on the prisoners that were working themselves to death for his program, literally working themselves to death for his program. So that was interesting. You know what? I wonder if you could read another just paragraph. I said before that you sprinkle history and science into the book. And I'm wondering if you could read the first paragraph of page 40, which is the beginning of the chapter that's titled The Vengeance Weapon.
Of course. I'd be happy to.
Great.
The world's first long-range rocket weighed almost 28,000 pounds and was so technologically advanced that Nazi Germany became the first country to put an object made by human hands into space. The common line marks the boundary between our world and the starry black that lies beyond. Thus, at least according to this measure, space begins 100 kilometers above sea level, which is roughly 62 miles straight up. During one particular test in the summer of 1944, launching from an island on the Baltic coast called Gerizvarda Oya, the V-2 soared past the Karman line by almost 50 miles. The Nazis, however, weren't interested in setting altitude records. They only cared about height, so that the V-2 could arc over the top of a deadly parabola and then scream its way back down toward Earth, where it would punch holes into cities hundreds of miles away. The V-2 was never designed to stay up in the heavens. It was designed to fall.
That was fascinating. I mean, this whole program that leads to space exploration and the success of NASA is really about, ultimately probably killing Americans, but certainly killing Europeans. And then you go on later to talk about some of the statistics, and these bombs killed, according to what you wrote in the book, they killed about 5,500 people during the war, mostly in the UK and Belgium, but also in Holland and France. 5,500 people died because of these bombs, but 20,000 people died building them at Dora Mittelbau.
Yes.
I've never seen those numbers. That is incredible.
It's very hard for me to imagine 20,000 people and to sort of, I have to think in terms of a football stadium, but my brain, I think that's the same for all of us. My brain cannot fathom that many people that die. But I mean, this is one of the ironies, I suppose, of the V-2 rocket program. It was far more deadly to the people building it than the people on the receiving end. And my wife is English, and I had the good fortune of meeting her grandmother before she passed away. And her grandmother, because she's English, of course, she survived the Blitz on England. And she was talking about how the Blitz was awful, but how the V-1 and the V-2 program was far worse because there was no warning signal. I mean, radar became suddenly useless. I mean, this thing is traveling at 5 times the speed of sound, so you'd only know a V-2 had hit when the explosion happened. And she said that was absolutely terrifying, mm-hmm. as I can only imagine it would be. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, the paragraph you just read, as I mentioned, it's from this chapter that's titled The Vengeance Weapon. And so I do always like to just know why somebody chooses to title their chapters. They were very helpful. I found it really good to know what you were going to title each chapter. But do you want to talk about making that decision?
Sure thing. The V in V2 stands for Vergeltungswaffe, which is German for the vengeance weapon. And I'm not entirely sure who named it that. I think, and I'm going out on a limb here, I could be wrong on this, but I suspect that that is the work of Joseph Goebbels, who was the Reichsminister for Propaganda, and this idea of a vengeance weapon, because of course Germany was being pounded night and day by British and American bombers. So this was the idea of this vengeance sort of bombing that was happening. But in doing my research on the development of the V-2, it was really interesting to see how this weapon, which changed warfare, it was not embraced by Hitler or the Nazis at first. And if it had been, I think it would have fundamentally changed the outcome of the war.
And as far as just titling chapters...
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I got away from you there. Yes.
No, it's an interesting title. So that's true. And I bet each of your titles has like a little bit of history behind it or a little bit of decision making behind it.
It's something I work hard on. In fact, I'm working on a new novel right now. I've just started the second chapter of the first draft, and I like the title, but I have to do a little more research to find out if it's historically accurate. So sometimes, just because I like the title of the chapter, I have to kind of go, ah, but that's not going to be accurate to what it needs to be, so I have to ditch it.
Yeah, that would be hard. Do the chapter titles move you forward, or is that something that would be maybe better done at the end?
It depends. I'll speak about what I'm working on right now, which I suppose we should really focus on Dora, but my mind's really absorbed on this new project, and I have the novel mostly mapped out, and some of the titles are already named, because I know what needs to happen in those chapters, and then there are others where I just have, a series of X's where I'll just fill it in. Yeah. So it kind of did. Sometimes I know right away, and other times the chapter's finished, and I have to kind of go, okay, what should I call it?
Yeah. Okay. All right. Great. I said I was going to ask you about this in writing the camp sections, and actually not just the camp sections. I mean, there are aspects of the Apollo section. It's not the same. I'm just wondering if you can talk about staying engaged despite cruelty, despite brutality, despite, you know, some pretty harsh material.
Yeah.
Staying engaged as a writer. I was always engaged as a reader, although it was upsetting. But as a writer, I would find it just kind of devastating.
It is. And I don't talk about it too much because I guess, I don't know, it sounds kind of melodramatic and it seems, I don't know, kind of strange to talk about how hard it can be to write this material, and it certainly is. The first novel, my first novel, The Commandant of Lubezetsch, was really hard to write, and in many ways much harder than In the Shadow of Dora. And what I have discovered in writing both of these Holocaust novels is that the first draft is always the hardest for me, emotionally. And then when it's done, I can kind of push away from the computer metaphorically, and then the next time I pull myself up to the computer to work on the second, third, fourth, fifth draft, I'm more of an editor at that point in time. And that offers a buffer, it offers some sort of distance. But when I'm working on the first draft, it can be really hard. So hard where after a couple of scenes, I kind of have to just hit Control S, save it, and leave my office. I go home and, you know, hang out with my family and go for a bike ride or something, and just try to step away from the 1940s.
Yeah, I can appreciate the fact that you don't like to talk about it, because in fact, the victims are the people you're writing about, not the author of the material. On the other hand, we are emotional creatures, and that would be hard. So.
Yes, yeah, it very much is, especially, as I'd said earlier, I became really attached, and I had a great deal of affection for my main character, Eli, and it was really hard to see some of these things happening to him.
Now, you've mentioned what you're working on next. What have you read anything lately that you would recommend to listeners, like two or three titles? Or,
you know, I'm in this strange situation where I tend to read material that I need to read in order to advance my own craft. So the last, I would say, half a year, I've just been reading a lot of material on a concentration camp called Ravensbrück, which is the first and only all-female concentration camp in the Third Reich. So I've been reading a lot of books on that, a lot of books about gender and violence. But there was one book that I read a couple of months ago by one of my favorite writers, and he was a writer that had a huge seismic influence on me when I was really starting off, and that's Tim O'Brien. You know, I'm from the state of Minnesota, and Tim O'Brien is from Minnesota, and I read The Things They Carried when it came out, and I was in my 20s, and it just blew open the doors of my imagination. So I read his latest book called Dad's Navy Book, which was just wonderful and lovely and heartbreaking, and it's about him being a dad later in life, and what does it mean to be a Vietnam War writer, and coming to terms with mortality, and it was just really a wonderful and really somber book at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, he's wonderful. Did you read, I think it's In the Lake of the Woods, is that his?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was such an interesting one, because it's like, you don't usually read books where the ending is offered in several different possible directions, right?
And yeah. I love the craft issues that I learned from In the Lake of the Woods, and that book, since you brought it up, had a real influence on my first novel, In the Commandant of Lubezetsch, because O'Brien would put these fake footnotes in there for sources. I was like, you can do that? I didn't know you could do that. So I started, you know, it gave me license to put footnotes in my own work.
You know who else did that? Is Ian McEwan did that in, it's not Atonement, it's the... Oh, I'm forgetting the name of it. But anyway, there's a book where he puts fake footnotes, and then, you know, some of the science is attributed to a scientist, and at a certain point I realized that it was an anagram for Ian McEwan, which was kind of fun. Okay, let's I wanted to talk about your details. your details. And it's interesting, you know, when you read the opening again of the book for this show, I kind of heard it anew because, of course, when I read it, I hadn't gotten through the whole book yet. Do you mind if I read something quickly?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd be honored.
So there's a scene. So as with the opening, there's a lot of just really terrible detail about this, the way they're treated and the conditions at the camp, and a lot of terrible things about filth and grime and dysentery and lice. But then there's a scene where Eli is taken out of the camp to help with a special project. I won't go into what it is. And there's this paragraph: the smell of bark and old leaves were all around him, as well as something else. He took a deep breath and couldn't place it. And then it dawned on him that he was smelling a clean world. For almost a year, he had been surrounded by thousands of men who hadn't bathed. But now in this clearing, with the wind moving through pine trees, everything was fresh and bright, pure. He filled up his lungs. It was the first time he had been beyond... Okay, I've screwed something up. Anyway, there was so much space, he thought. Freedom was so close. That is just so... It's funny because against all of the filth and grime and everything else that you depict, you know, with equal detail in the book, this was like this moment of... This is the promise of what lays beyond and possibly after. It's also what he will be denied in about a half an hour, you know, and what will tease him. But anyway, I just wondered if we could talk about detail, and I know that that's a really big question, but when you're writing, does your detail tend to sort of just come as a part of the writing process, or do you take a lot of notes during your research to go like, wow, you know, here's this prisoner who went outside and he smelled the clarity of the air for the first time? I don't know. Do you have any thoughts?
It's a little of both, actually. Now that I think about it, as I'm going through the, you know, when writing is going really well, no one in the Greeks called it the muse, because it feels like it's not coming from you. And I love that moment where I'm writing so fast, it doesn't feel like I'm doing it. I love that sense of surrender, and I know musicians feel this way too. The music kind of flows through them in a performance. Often the detail will come out as the character is telling me what he or she is sort of experiencing. But I do an awful lot of field research because I think it's necessary for me to go to the places where history happened. And in so doing, I always run across things I wouldn't have noticed previously. You know, certain types of birds or trees, the way the sun sort of hits the landscape, or even just the topography of the land. I mean, when I was at Dora Mittelbau, I stood on the roll call square. And I stood in the spot where I knew that Eli would roughly be, and I was sort of, you know, closed my eyes, and I was sort of imagining what this potentially could be like in 1944, you know, that great leap of imagination. And then I could see in the distance, I could see the town of Nordhausen, and I could hear the church bells ringing. And had I not been there, I never would have added that detail into the book. So it's a little bit of both. It's a long, circuitous road to finally get to answering your question, but there it is.
No, that's great. Now that's exactly what I was wondering. So I like to finish up these interviews with asking for a little bit of advice. And because I don't like spoilers, I'm not going to talk a lot about the Apollo section of the book. We've touched on it a little bit, but I do want to just address it in terms of writing and structure. In the Shadow of Dora, as we've already said, has a two-part structure from one section that has its own unique set of rules. And I liked that you said that it's like it's got the arc of the rocket going from one thing to another. So I wonder if you can talk about how this went for you as you worked, and also just sort of offer maybe some more general advice about finding structure, maybe transitioning from one thing to another as we work.
Yeah. And this was a really unusual novel because it is a two-part novel, as you mentioned, but sometimes I think of it as like almost two novellas with the same character, and they've been sort of put together. And when I was working on the first draft, as I'd finished part one, I remember taking a deep breath and thinking, this whole thing is going to collapse if I can't successfully transform him to 1969. And thank goodness, when I started to write the first maybe page of the first draft of part two, that's when I had that epiphany that I need to see the country through Eli Hessel's eyes and not through my own eyes. And once that came to me, then everything else seemed to sort of fall into place pretty easily. But I really did have to transform how I looked at the history of my country. And I realized that I had to think psychologically differently, where Eli is no longer in survival mode. He's in living mode and trying to figure out how to carry the weight of what he experienced with him. And I enjoyed the challenge of doing that with this last novel, and with every novel I write, I try to set myself new craft challenges. So one I'm working on right now I've never done before, and I think it'll work. question mark. I'm on chapter 2, and it seems to be working out, but we'll see what happens.
So is that a structural thing that you're talking about?
It is a structural thing, and I won't get into it too much, but it takes place in the female camp of Ravensbrück, and I canter between the perspective of a female SS guard and one of the female prisoners, and the chapters go back and forth, and the reader can see what these two characters don't know, and I think it's working, but wish me luck.
Good luck. And so that's the point, like, you think it's working, but what happens when it's not working? Like, have you ever abandoned a structure or had to like change something because it just simply was not doing it?
I wrote a novel 4 years ago, and after I finished the first draft, I always give it to my wife, who has no training in writing at all. She's a reader, and my ironclad rule is, if she stops reading the book, then I failed. Right? And she got halfway through this novel and she's like, it's not doing it for me. And so I looked at it and I sent it to my agent and he said, yeah, not doing it for me. So I abandoned it and I haven't looked back.
Had you suspected it wasn't working?
Yeah, I did. It was written shortly after the 2016 election, and I realize now it's just sort of means of trying to process what that was all about. And so it will never be published, and I'm okay with that. I did write a novel about the B-17 bombers that were based in England in 1942, and I'm not entirely happy with the ending, and I think I'm going to revisit that novel in a couple of years and just lop off the last third of it and try to write the ending again, because I like that novel, but it's not ending yet the way it should. Yeah.
That's really helpful, I think. I think people need to hear that sometimes you have to throw some pages away. Sometimes you have to put the book away for a while finishing it. But anyway, okay, great. I want to mention again that the name of the book is In the Shadow of Dora, a novel of the Holocaust and the Apollo program by Patrick Hicks, who's been my guest today. It's published by the Stephen F. Austin State University Press. Patrick, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, it's been an absolute delight and a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Patrick Hicks about a book that I just really enjoyed, In the Shadow of Dora, published by Stephen F. Austin University Press. You can learn more about his work at patrickhicks.org. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Patrick Hicks. In order to develop new characters and make them believable, it's crucial to know their likes and dislikes. Patrick spends quite a bit of time doing character sketches before he starts writing in order to know their backgrounds and personalities. For fun, I thought this was a great spin on this, he sends his characters to the grocery store to buy 5 items. What do they need? What do they buy? Don't think about this for very long, just write it down. What they buy will tell you something about their personalities, their wants and desires, and their daily lives. How do they get to the grocery store? By bus? Car? What kind of car do they drive? Why that particular kind of car? Do they have bumper stickers? What's in the car? How are they dressed when they go shopping? What are they thinking about as they move through the aisles? what's on their mind. Although this exercise takes less than 10 minutes, Patrick finds that it illuminates aspects of his characters that are new to him. He likes following them around and observing them. It offers surprising details, and he can see his characters more clearly as individuals. And he also told me that his students love this exercise as well. So good luck with your work in the coming week. I hope this helps. Tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I hope you're doing well. I hope you're feeling well. I hope that you are able to read and write and maybe get together with people. It's so nice to be able to see people in person again. Keep in mind that the archives of the show offer weekly writing prompts to help you in your work if you are trying to write. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors and poets and even editors, agents, people that you're interested in the book industry. If you have events to announce, you can also send me those, and I try to read them, if I have time, the week of the event. If you like the show, please rate it wherever you get your podcasts, and like it on Facebook, talk about it, and tweet about it. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We are also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.